Hello and welcome to SSI Live. You've long known the Strategic Studies Institute, or SSI, at the U.S. Army War College as the go-to location for issues related to national security and military strategy with an emphasis on geostrategic analysis. SSI conducts strategic research and analysis to support the U.S. Army War College curricula, assist and inform Army, DoD, and U.S. government leadership, and serve as a bridge to the wider strategic community. Now we're bringing you access to SSI analyses, scholars, and guests through this, the SSI Live podcast series. Thanks for joining us. Hello and welcome to this edition of SSI Live. My name is John Denny and I'm a research professor of National Security Studies here at the Strategic Studies Institute, or SSI, at the U.S. Army War College. It's Wednesday, January 5th, and today I'm joined by Dr. Evan Ellis. Evan is our Latin American expert, and I've asked him to talk to us today about the seeming turn to the political left unfolding recently across Latin America. Evan, welcome.
Thanks, John. It's good to be part of the program.
Evan, let me begin by asking you to give us the broad brush strokes of this shift to the left. There have been headlines recently about elections in Honduras and Chile, but where else has this been unfolding exactly across the region?
Great question, John. First of all, of course, the left has many different meanings, everything from a political center-left to a more populist or authoritarian left to certain types of populism that may not entirely be to the left. But in general, you can talk about a confluence of different things. On the one hand, you have the consolidation of leftist populist or authoritarian regimes such as Venezuela, as we saw with the recent local elections, Nicaragua with their November sham election, and of course, Cuba with the Díaz-Canel regime. You can see the deepening of certain leftist movements and their radicalization as they've gotten into problems. So Andrés Manuel López Obrador in Mexico, especially his foreign policy, you've seen the return of some leftist regimes and their deepening, such as the return of the MAS in Bolivia or the return of the Peronists in Argentina, and especially the more radical wing of former President Cristina Fernandez. And of course, you have some new turns to the left. You have leftist school teacher Pedro Castillo in Peru with the hard left, Cuban agent Vladimir Cerrón behind him there in Peru. You have in Honduras the recent election of Xiomara Castro with her Libre movement. And of course, Chile, traditionally well governed, but the election of a young, relatively populist leader Gabriel Boric. And then, of course, you have upcoming prospects. So, for example, in Colombia with those that nation's May presidential elections this year, and then Brazil with the possibility of left-of-center Lula da Silva coming back in October.
Okay, Evan, you painted a picture for us of very recent elections, let's say the second half or in 2021, but also this trend unfolding perhaps for the last couple of years and perhaps continuing to unfold as we look to elections coming up in Brazil and Colombia. This kind of region-wide trend echoes what we saw about 15 years ago, I think, and many observers characterized the phenomenon as it unfolded then as the pink tide, this resurgence of leftist parties or center-left parties in Latin American elections. And it was, back then, something of a regional wave in which we saw socioeconomic inequality across the region generating broad support for these left-of-center parties. Do you see what's unfolded recently and might continue to unfold in 2022 as another kind of budding pink tide?
It's a great question, John. And certainly there is similarities with respect to both that shift to the left as part of a kind of pendulum with the region going back and forth between left and right solutions. And there are certainly similarities in the variety of different leftist regimes we had then and now between some center left that accepted democracy versus more populist left that rejected. But I see the current shift is much more extensive and in many ways much more dangerous strategically for the United States. First of all, overall, again, it involves a far greater number of countries and some which are far more entrenched that build on actually those things that happened and were never fully reconciled back in that first wave that we call the Pink Tide. Second, of course, what's happening now is much more radicalized by the effects of COVID-19, not only the health effects, but also the fiscal effects in constraining government's ability to give some of the things that they need to their people, as well as some of the economic effects that have come with COVID-19 and some of the mobilization and other political effects that have come with it. In addition, you have other strains. We can talk about the Venezuelan diaspora, some 7 million or more Venezuelans who have really migrated throughout the region, not just Colombia, but the Caribbean, Guyana, Ecuador, Chile, and have had impacts both economically and in other domains like criminality with all of those countries. Also, the development of regimes such as the Chavistas in Venezuela, etc., what you now see is evidence that the lessons learned by that left has been used in many ways to weaponize some discontent and protest now. We saw it in Chile in October 2019. We saw it in Ecuador. We saw it most recently in Colombia with the radicalization of some of the protests there this year. And what we really are looking at now, thus, is virtually the entire region, with the exception of Ecuador, where Guillermo Lasso hangs on by a thread, with the exception of the center right, which continues to hold on with Le Calle Po in Ecuador, in Uruguay, and to some degree, other countries such as Paraguay. But with very, very few exceptions, the movement and thus the synergies between these leftist parties of various types are far beyond what we saw. Again, 15 years ago.
You know, I want to get Evan to some of the strategic implications of this in just a minute, but let me ask you to unpack a little bit further for us some of the reasons for this. Now, you mentioned the impact of COVID, as well as migrant waves or migrant flows within Latin America. But if we look back 15 years ago, we know that socioeconomic inequality drove a lot of this rise in strength or power of left of center parties. Do you see that as explaining some of this trend right now? And I think this is probably important to get to because it could speak to policy recommendations eventually if Washington is looking to address this in some way. If we can unpack a bit the leading explanatory variables, maybe there's a way ahead here. So what's your sense of what explains this trend right now?
Great question, John. And certainly every story is different in the particulars, but you do see common elements. So as you alluded to, in Latin America in general, there has been an accumulated frustration with endemic corruption, with poverty, with inequality, and generally what you might consider relatively poor performance of democracies and free market economies in solving some of those problems that are really at the heart of the day-to-day concern of Latin Americans. Now, on top of that, again, you have other things that have made things worse. So again, with the COVID-19 crisis, you not only had the augmenting of frustrations with government because, mismanaged shutdowns, mismanaged, purchases of ventilators and PPE and things like that, really just compounded the frustration that citizens had over other issues. On top of that, again, it pushed many people who were just barely in the middle class back into the informal sector in much more desperate circumstances, augmenting their frustration. In addition to that, again, you had fiscal constraints. Overall, in Latin America, debt as a percentage of GDP increased by about 10 percentage points in 1 year, which basically left many Latin American governments really very strapped in terms of being able to augment police forces, to provide additional solutions with respect to social programs, infrastructure projects that could provide value added in meaningful jobs. So it really left a lot of Latin American governments not only with the frustrations of their people, but fiscally constrained in how they could deal with those. But then on top of that, again, you have these other specialty effects. And so, again, the learning of the radical left of how to weaponize protests. And so you saw it again in Colombia, where, again, people came out into the streets in Cali, in Bogota, in Medellin for legitimate reasons. But it was certain radical elements that turned those violent, that created destabilization. And that push the politics in certain direction. Another thing that we see now that we didn't have 15 years ago is the effect, especially of Chinese money. Now, the Chinese are not, in my judgment, trying to overthrow governments in the same way that the Soviet Union did with subversive military support to the FMLN in El Salvador, or the Sandinistas, the FSLN in Nicaragua. But the Chinese, in pursuing their own objectives, making sure that they get paid, but not really concerned with the types of governance or the types of democracy, et cetera, are providing money that essentially serve as incubators of these new populist regimes. We saw it with Ecuador and Rafael Correa in Ecuador. We saw it with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. But the result is that as these regimes try to change their constitutions, as they try to pack their own institutions and violate separation of power, as they try to move against the press and the private sector, in previous eras, you'd get some pushback. You'd get capital flight. You'd get institutional pushback that sometimes would swing the pendulum back to the right. But with Chinese money, those leaders are able to take these radicalizations much farther and thus lock themselves into power for the long haul. And in some ways, that prevents the pendulum from swinging back in the way that perhaps it was able to do in many countries 15 years ago.
Evan, speaking of the role of China in this unfolding trend across the region, let's zoom out now and talk about the strategic implications and how this shift might affect Washington's or America's interests in the region. What do you see? Give us the big picture first before we dive into sort of the security related elements. But what do you see as the main broad strategic implications of this shift?
Well, John, first of all, the critical starting point is to recognize that even though we have long focused our foreign policy engagement in Asia and the Middle East and in other places of importance to us, there is really, in terms of the numbers, no part of the world that is more directly contributing to our prosperity and security than Latin America. We are intimately tied by bonds of geography, by bonds of our investment in bilateral commerce, by bonds of family and in immigration. When things are bad in the region, we feel it in ways, whether we're talking about the migrant crisis or other things that are very direct and immediate and really become matters of domestic U.S. policy. Having said that, then, an understanding that what happens in the region matters. First of all, this turn to the left in general tends to make the region less cooperative overall to U.S. Encouragement or pressures on issues of importance to both Democrats and Republicans. And so the human rights agenda and democracy and good governance and things like that, the types of root causes that Vice President Harris wants to put forward. But at the same time, it also makes it less cooperative on matters like transnational organized crime and drug cooperation in migration issues, where we actually saw we had the importance of cooperation in places like Central America during the previous administration. So even as the region becomes less cooperative with those things, also the things that directly affect the U.S. tend to become worse by states that their politics can compound their fiscal crises, can compound capital flight. And so overall, what we tend to see is that these types of shifts tend to increase poverty, increase corruption, increase or at least create economic and fiscal crises, impair good governance, which again, has other effects in terms of the ability of transnational criminal organizations to operate there, et cetera. We've seen this occur in catastrophic proportions in Venezuela, and we're beginning to see it in other places. Number three, it affects our strategic equities because these regimes, especially the populist left, tend to be far more willing and need to bring in other actors that we consider threatening. China, Russia, and Iran most particularly, but also we can talk about Turkey and others. Now, it's not just the economic role of those actors, but we find that the populist leftists in particular are far more willing to engage in ways that particularly worry the United States, whether it's acquiring weapons, not only Russian weapons, but also Chinese weapons, as the Venezuelans did, as the Ecuadorians did under Rafael Correa with the purchase of 709 military trucks, as the Bolivians did under Evo Morales, as well as other types of security apparatuses of concern, surveillance architectures like ECU 911, 11 in Ecuador under Correa, BOL 110 in Bolivia, et cetera, et cetera. And certainly we've seen how the Venezuelan regime has created an open door, not only for the Chinese to come in the oil sector, but the Russians to come in with their Tu-160 backfire bombers and their air defense coordination and things like that. The Iranians coming in with their Mojaher drones, with their activities in various other sectors and possibly collaboration on weapons production. And then the other piece is frankly, that those ungoverned spaces also in conjunction with a lack of cooperation create spaces for criminal actors that directly hurt the United States through, you know, drug flows leading to drug overdoses, migration, and other things. So, for example, in Mexico right now, we have the left-of-center government of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO, who passed a new security law that significantly impaired the ability of DEA to operate in the country, significantly constrained the way in which the U.S. military could operate, especially in the domain of internal security, et cetera. So it makes the region more dangerous, it brings in other threat actors, and it makes it more difficult for us to cooperate to solve these collective problems that we have with the region.
Evan, I think I need to draw you out though on this one, on the point of the populist left versus merely, or quote-unquote merely, the left-of-center governments, right? And I want to go back maybe to something we were talking about earlier, the trends in the region. Is it your sense that, well, first of all, from what you've said, the populist left parties clearly pose a greater challenge, maybe even a greater threat to American interests, right? Is it your sense that it's the populist left that is really on the rise across the region? Or can we not say that yet? And it's more broadly left of center. What's your sense?
It's a combination of both, because there's really an interaction effect between the populist left and others. And so traditionally what you find is that, again, a country like Venezuela, where you really had a roadmap with Hugo Chavez and now Nicolas Maduro, where they brought in the Cubans and Cuban counterintelligence, but they also really architected a way to leverage this to push leftist solutions in other places and then create crises and use those crises to radicalize the government. And so, for example, you look at a situation like in Argentina, where little by little, the more kind of radical segment represented by Cristina Fernandez, La Campora, is trying to put her people in key ministerial positions, is trying to, you know, pack some of the government judiciary organs, is trying to push things in a way that Alberto Fernandez, the centrist leftist, maybe doesn't want to go. We're facing a similar type of debate right now with Xiomara Castro. There are some real bad actors within the Libre movement in Honduras. And so the question is, okay, right now, Xiomara Castro, who shares certain objectives with the Biden administration on things like anti-corruption and possibly restoring an anti-corruption commission, has also, there's the temptation to ally either in foreign policy or in certain types of collaboration, again, whether it's recognizing the Chinese or collaborating with other like-minded leftists, such as the Venezuelans, et cetera. We saw this with the FMLN before also, where, again, even though in the FMLN, Salvador Sanchez Seren's government was not necessarily anti-democratic, but it wove a collection of money and corruption through, for example, the ALBA organization that really opened the door. And so even in a place, for example, right now, like Chile, where you have, again, good governance, there's nothing to say that Gabriel Boric is anti-democratic. But the issue is that his key coalition partner is the Chilean Communist Party, aka of Salvador Allende fame. He is going to be creating some really significant financial crises. And so in the context of those crises, who is he pushed to ally with? Will he move towards the center or will the communists and his coalition and others push him in a different direction? And so one doesn't want to say that all left-of-center governments are anti-democratic, but because of the nature of the populist left engagement, there is a certain risk, not only in foreign policy, but other types of collaboration, that open door moves us in a direction. It becomes hard for us to cooperate, and it also opens up a bit of a contagion effect that these governments are hold down this path, both because of increasing frictions with the United States and others, and because of the way that the certain key actors. So, for example, Xiomara Castro's government in Honduras, some of the people that are involved, one of her deputies, for example, was one of the organizers of the migrant caravans that created so much problems for us back just a couple months ago. And so it's playing out in a lot of different ways, but it's neither correct to say that it's just the left, everything's okay, but neither is it to say that any left of government is immediately a danger. And so there's a balance between we try to work with these governments and hope for the best, but we have to recognize the inherent risks of who's in the coalition, what types of agendas are behind the scenes.
Evan, that's great. I appreciate you explaining that nuance there, and the what sound like the risks of a slippery slope in some cases. Let me get back to the implications of this unfolding trend that we're discussing. And now let's home in specifically on the national security related implications, specifically for the Department of Defense and our national security enterprise in the U.S. What are some of the leading implications of this shift? You mentioned it becomes more difficult for these governments to perhaps work with the U.S., or maybe they're less likely or less willing to work with us. Will we see implications of that in national security terms?
Absolutely. And we've already seen them, and I think we'll continue to see more. So again, in Mexico, the AMLO government is not necessarily purely anti-democratic. However, for a number of different reasons, they did pass that national security law that makes it very difficult, takes away the immunity of DEA operatives, constrains the ability of us to do certain types of military cooperation. And even though we have a new security cooperation framework called the Bicentennial Framework, it's not clear what meaningful things that will actually bring about. You have some on-the-table questions. So, for example, in El Salvador, you have an increasingly defiant government of Nayib Bukele, who maybe wouldn't be considered to the left, but as a populist, and of course, so we have one of our very important forward operating locations, Comalapa, there. Even a bigger question is Joint Task Force Bravo in the Sotocano Air Base in Honduras. So some within the Libre movement have talked about shutting down Sotocano, which is important not only for Honduras, but projection throughout the region. The same thing we saw with Rafael Correa back in 2007 when we got kicked out of the critical Pacific-facing base in Manta. So there's all those types of access issues. Now, in some places like Argentina, despite what happened in the previous government where we were effectively shut out of their Ministry of Defense and shut out of counter-narcotics cooperation, thus far, we still have not been shut out as extensively, but it does raise issues of concern. So literally, it's just you go from country to country. In every case, it's slightly different in terms of how much latitude our SCO teams have. But in each case, the politics create sometimes just sensitivities. Sometimes they create legal imperatives. Sometimes you have personnel that are put in, with an anti-U.S. bent in terms of the persons who are responsible for liaison with the U.S. with the explicit purpose of creating obstacles in the relationships, et cetera. In some cases, there's a desire to decrease cooperation, whether it's with, financial investigation units, FIUs, or the DEA or others, in order to free up opportunities, for corruption. But then the bottom line is in all of those cases, it makes it more difficult to cooperate on transnational crime issues, on corruption issues, and things like that. And again, you have also some, direct issues such as coordinating on migratory flows, coordinating on counter-narcotics, operations that directly impact, the ability to monitor, drugs coming in across the Mexican border or drugs coming in through the southeast approaches in the Caribbean. So at the end of the day, the decreased ability of us to coordinate intimately with those with whom we are geographically proximate really constrains our ability to have what we would call a defense in depth in national security in this hemisphere. And the final part is we already previously alluded to as well, is the question of not only decreased working with us and increased problems, but also a more open door to threat actors. Russia, again, Iran. And so, you know, already in Venezuela, you can see, for example, Wagner Group operatives. You can see, again, nuclear capable bombers, coming in. Now, while China has thus far avoided those types of provocative, basing agreements and things like that, you have to understand that where you have military-to-military cooperation, that in the context of, for example, a war that could break out over Taiwan or in elsewhere in Southeast Asia, that the question then becomes that even without a basing agreement, if certain partners agreed to it, how quickly would the Chinese be able to deploy assets in the region, whether it was special operations or intelligence operatives or creating diversionary crises, or maybe even in the context of a broader war in Asia, the ability actually to take advantage of a partner, maybe in Nicaragua or maybe Venezuela or maybe Argentina, to say, okay, this time around, we're going to bet against the United States, and we're going to allow Chinese to do port calls or to resupply an airbase. And then all of a sudden, Southcom, which is the AOR for, counter drugs and things like that that are long time considered less sexy, suddenly becomes critical in terms of real risks to the U.S. homeland in that context, and also, frankly, risks to the TIPFID flows and to the sustainment flows that PACOM rely on to actually conduct that war. So there are all kinds of issues that are a lot bigger than just, more drugs and more annoyance in the region.
Evan, I really appreciate you painting that that picture for us and explaining this. This has been a fascinating conversation. I'm grateful for you taking the time today. I think it'd be interesting if we re-engage on this, perhaps in a few months after the elections in Colombia and Brazil. I think it'd be interesting to get your take on how this this is continuing to unfold. But for now, Professor Evan Ellis, research professor at SSI, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your expertise and insights.
Thank you, John. Always a pleasure.
You can now find SSI Live on TuneIn Radio and on popular podcast directories like Stitcher and at the iTunes Store. If you have any comments on our podcasts, thoughts on what you'd like to see addressed, or a response to something you heard here at SSI Live, please go to our website. That's ssi.armywarcollege.edu. Find me, John Denny, in the staff directory, and send me an email. I look forward to hearing from you. For the SSI Live podcast series, I'm John Denny. Thanks for listening.